Starbucks, a company focused on the ethical sustainability of their coffee and known for having a shop, or two, or three, on every street corner, had years of caffeine-fueled growth.
But in 2007, when the recession hit, they quickly discovered the headache of more supply than demand, and competitors quickly grinding their profits down to dregs.
So, how did these Java purveyors perk up their products and brew their way to a fresh pot of success?
Let's find out. This is Starbucks on the Brink.
You know, Ariel, I thought we should tackle Starbucks earlier, but then I thought that's a tall order.
I was going to say I needed my coffee first.
Yeah.
I like yours better.
Yeah, we're talking about Starbucks. Just to get things out of the way, we usually like to talk about our own experiences with companies before we start diving in. I'm a regular visitor to Starbucks. There's one right across the street from the office we're recording in, and and I have been known to waltz in there and request a coffee.
I hope they give you a discount for the dancing. I like Starbucks, but mainly for the Java chip frappuccino, which half the time you have to ask for specifically. I used to be a barista at a little independent coffee shop.
Yeah.
That was not Starbucks.
I've got a friend who was a barista at also a not Starbucks, but it was a cafe that sold Starbucks coffee at a Barnes & Noble. But it was a torturous experience for her because they were not technically a Starbucks, so they couldn't take Starbucks forms of payment because they weren't a Starbucks.
Yeah.
But they sold Starbucks coffee, which in the minds of consumers was a confusing thing. And so I still jokingly refer to her as a former Starbucks employee.
That's horrible of you and very funny.
But we're going to talk a lot about the company and how it grew very quickly and then how that almost sabotaged the entire company. Also, this is a company that is largely known for their very well-publicized stance on ethical considerations, something that we thought was kind of important to bring up, but we also want to acknowledge that fairly recently, there's been this enormous deal between Starbucks and
Nestle. And the Nestle company.
Yeah, and the Nestle company is kind of the opposite when you talk about reputations for ethical behavior. Nestle has a long laundry list of practices that certainly fall on the questionable, if not outright unethical side. And on the most horrifying part of that list comes the fact that a lot of the chocolate coming out to come to Nestle for their products could very well be the product of child slave labor on the Ivory Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty awful stuff. And it also was kind of shocking to me to see Starbucks have this corporate agreement with Nestle. Now, for the record, the agreement is that Nestle will be able to carry Starbucks products in places that are not Starbucks
stores. That's what I was about to say. So grocery stores and things.
Yeah. So it's the idea that Nestle becomes the perpetual rights owner for marketing Starbucks products outside of the coffee shops themselves.
But it still makes you look at it and scratch your head a little bit.
Yeah. It's one of those deals where you see how much the deal was for. We're talking billions of dollars. But you think, yeah, but you're kind of trading on some of that good faith you've built up with your reputation in the process.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's surprising because their ethical stance has been in place since the company was founded.
Yeah, let's talk about the history of this company and how they got to that point where we have identified as the Brink.
Sure. Well, it was started by three guys who met in the University of San Francisco, Jerry Baldwin, Zev Siegel, and Gordon Bowker. And when they were in college, they learned how to roast coffee beans from Alfred Peet, who owns Peet's Coffee.
Yeah, and Peet's Coffee is another famous brand. If I don't think people are as familiar with Peet's as they are with Starbucks, is interesting.
I am, mainly because Peet's makes Keurig cups, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe I've seen those.
Well, and I've definitely been to a Peet's Coffee coffee house before. He established his very first coffee bar back in 1966, and he was originally from the Netherlands. And according to the website for Peet's Coffee, he was taken aback by how terrible American coffee was And so he was determined to introduce Americans to what good coffee should taste like, and that was the foundation of Pete's Coffee. So we'll have to do a Brink episode on him at some point.
We will. And, you know, to be fair, he did, because he inspired these three gentlemen to start their own coffee store, and they did in 1971. Mm-hmm. The first Starbucks opened in March in Seattle of that year, and they weren't a coffee house. They roasted beans, and they sold beans, and they ground beans, and then they sold tea and spices.
Right. So you couldn't order a cup of coffee there, but you could order a pound of coffee.
I do like to pound my coffee.
Yeah. I mean, when I get up first thing in the morning, I got to do that too, or else nothing else happens. So first decade of their existence, they're operating this way, and they're doing business in Seattle. And in 1982, they make a big, big hire, someone who would end up becoming incredibly important to the future of the company.
Yes. They hire Howard Schultz as the director of marketing and retail operations, who was, in fact, CEO until very recently. Mm-hmm. We'll go into some more details about that, because it's not just a straight shot.
Yeah, he's got a long history with Starbucks that also has some gaps in it, but we'll cover all that.
And he had had his first cup of Starbucks coffee a year before, and he really liked it. So he was gung-ho about joining the company. And he has Starbucks start selling their coffee to espresso bars and restaurants.
The next year, in 83, I'm sure on a fact-finding mission, he traveled to Milan. And that's where he had the European experience with coffee. And he went to a coffee bar, and he thought, hang on. This might be a really good thing to bring back to the States.
And he did. And in 1984, Starbucks tested out its first coffee house.
Yep. And the coffee house is in Seattle, the original one. It's funny because their original location, their storefront location where they sold the coffee and the grounds and the teas, doesn't exist anymore. People think of the original Starbucks, and they're thinking about a location that's in Pike Place Market in Seattle. Mm-hmm. That's a famous market in Seattle. It's where they throw fish around at people. That really does happen.
Sounds like home.
Oh, yeah. You just see these enormous fish flying through the air as they're tossing from one station to another. It's a really vibrant, incredible place, and I've been there several times, and I love Pike Place Market. But the Starbucks that's there is not the original Starbucks, because it was in a different location. It was across the street when they first built their first storefront. It is probably, I guess, the oldest of their coffee bar Starbucks is the one that's actually in Pike Place. If you want to go there, you totally can. You can get your picture taken in front of it. You can go and stand in line for a coffee. You will stand in line for a long time because it is a tourist destination at this point.
See that?
Just walk two blocks to the next nearest Starbucks. Trust me, it is much faster. I have done it.
I was about to say, because Starbucks has very strict standards in place, so your coffee's going to be just about as good at any location.
Yeah. No, it's for the experience. And in fact, as we'll see, that was one of the things Schultz really set upon, was the idea that this is experiential. This is the going to this coffee shop shouldn't just be about a transaction. It should be an experience.
He felt, when he was in Milan, he felt like it was a community building event to go to a coffee bar.
Yeah, this was a social thing, not just to grab your cup of Joe and get out the door. So that would become a very important component of the identity of the company.
Yes.
So in 1985, Starbucks incorporates, but Schultz has his first departure from Starbucks. It will not be his last.
Nope.
And he goes on to run a different line of coffee houses that had the name, and I shall butcher this, for I am not Italian, Il Giornale.
Sounds good to me.
I know. It's probably awful. It's probably totally wrong,
though. Just the accent. It's just the accent on it.
Yeah, but he actually, through this coffee shop, he was still very much associated with Starbucks because they were selling Starbucks brand coffee.
Yes. Well, and even more so, 2 years later in 1987, I'm going to call it Il G.
Okay.
Because I also do not speak Italian.
I like that. I like the idea. It sounds like a hip-hop star.
It is. It's a very hip place. Il G. By Starbucks,
Yeah. So the coffee shop that Schultz goes to work for, the line of coffee shops that he goes to work for, has now gotten big enough to actually come back and acquire Starbucks.
Yes. And then they become the Starbucks Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling like maybe somewhere in there, Starbucks just wasn't moving quick enough on the coffee house idea. And so he's like, I'm going to start my idea on my own and then bring Starbucks back into it because I really do like the product.
Yeah.
And then same year, Starbucks opened, now that they're the Starbucks Corporation, they opened locations in Vancouver and Chicago and more locations in Seattle. And we see the very beginning of Starbucks' incredible growth.
Right. And also the beginning of Schultz acting as CEO of the company. He becomes the chief executive officer. And then the next year in 88, Starbucks does something truly as a pioneer in the industry and starts offering up healthcare for both full and part-time employees. And I mean, I remember like when I was in college, I remember colleagues in college. No one worked where I was at least not in class, but colleagues saying that they were going to work at Starbucks while in college and even maybe a couple years after, largely because it was a great way to not just earn money, but to get those healthcare benefits.
Yeah, I mean, they really, over the years, and we'll hit some more milestones later on as we talk about it, but they really have shown, in large part, a care for their employees. They've got health insurance. They invest in educational programs and how to roast beans.
And they had even like stock options and things like that for employees in the early days that really, I mean, if you were a Starbucks employee in the early days and you were exercising those stock options, you'll hear about how that stock has done over the years. It was not it was a nice way to be compensated. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, but we haven't quite gotten there yet.
No.
By 1989, so just 2 years after Schultz became CEO of Starbucks and incorporated his own line of coffee houses into it, they had over 50 stores.
Mm-hmm.
So 50 stores in 2 years, that's pretty good growth,
yeah.
I would say.
I mean, it's a drop in the bucket of what would follow, but drop a coffee in the bucket. But we'll
I'll drop a coffee in the percolator.
Yep, sure thing. In 1990, they created their mission statement for the company, which is, and this is a quote, "to establish Starbucks as the premier purveyor of the finest coffees in the world while maintaining our uncompromising principles as we grow," which is a pretty lofty goal to say that we want to have the best and we don't want to have to bend in order to do it. And this was really an important element in, again, their corporate identity and just the way they do business.
So a year later in 1991, this is when they start offering stock to their employees, equity in the company. They were still a private company at the time, but they were also offering stock to part-time employees, and they were the first private company to do that.
Yeah, and they call it bean stock.
Bean stock, which is adorable.
Yeah.
And, you know, in 2 years, they had doubled their stores. So now they're up to 100 stores.
And the following year, they would hold their public offering. They would become a publicly traded company. So they made the transition from private to public in 1992. And the opening trading price of a share of Starbucks stock was $17 per share. And at the end of that first day, it had climbed up to $21.50. So not some ridiculous, super overinflated price, but, you know, generally speaking, when you open up for a private, you know, go from private to publicly held company and on that first day of trading, seeing the number go up during the day is typically thought of as a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's pretty cool that they let their employees invest in the company before going public because now their employees have a foot up.
Yeah. And then just a year later, a year after going public, they do a 2-for-1 stock split. And we've talked about stock splits in past episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, what you're doing is you're doubling the number of shares of stock, but you're halving the price per share because you can't just magically double the value of your company, right? Because your value of your company is number of shares times however much per share.
Not ethically, at least.
Yeah, not ethically, yeah. I'm pretty sure Mel Brooks would write a musical about it if that were a possibility, but no. So sometimes when a stock price gets really high, a company will choose to do a 2-for-1 or more split in order to bring that stock price down. You increase the number of shares out there and you encourage more trading of shares. At least that's the thought process. So going on as a public company in 92 and then in 93 already holding your first 2-for-1 split, that's the sign of a company that's growing.
Yes, yes. And they grew even more because 1995, they did another 2-for-1 stock split.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, they introduced Frappuccinos.
That's probably why they had to do a 2-for-1 stock split, because, listen, I've been in a lot of Starbucks lines, and Frappuccino is a word frequently in use.
Well, I mean, they bought the right to the Frappuccino drink from Coffee Connection. Mm. It wasn't their creation. They might have improved upon it or tweaked it. And as I said before, Java Chip is my favorite Starbucks drink.
Yeah, whereas I didn't mention mine. My favorite Starbucks drink is just an iced coffee.
But also in 1995, I mean, iced coffee is good. Iced coffee is good. In 1995, they opened their first LEED certified store.
Mm.
So their first green store.
It's,
you know, again, moving in that direction.
And you see here a lot of the philosophy of the Pacific Northwest, too, mm-hmm. which tends to be associated with things like environmentally conscious and very concerned with human rights, that sort of thing. And you're seeing that kind of get ingrained into the corporate culture of Starbucks.
Yeah.
In 96, we get a product that my wife lived on for probably about 5 years, Frappuccinos in bottles.
It's very nutritious.
And they opened up their first international store.
In Japan.
Mm.
By this time, they had over 1,000 stores. So they increased the number of stores by 10 times or more in 5 years.
Yep. They had more growth both domestically and internationally in 97. And they organized the Starbucks Foundation, which is a community outreach branch of Starbucks. Mm-hmm. So this is pretty cool. It's, again, this idea of giving back to your community and not just profiting off of it. So the earliest programs were all focused on literacy programs in the United States and Canada. But now they do lots of other stuff, not just literacy programs. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they support youth programs, community service, agricultural programs, because they're all about sustainability and ethical growing practices of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
In 1998, Starbucks started going into grocery stores, which is fantastic for me. And a horrible, horrible temptation because I probably should not drink 6 bottled Frappuccinos a week.
Yep. And then they also founded Cup. Now, tell me about Cup, because this was something where I had not heard about it before this podcast.
So Cup stands for Caring Unites Partners. And it was a fund started by some partners. Now, Starbucks calls all their employees partners.
Okay.
Because they're allowed to have a share in the company.
Mm-hmm.
They want their community to invest in them, so they invest in their community.
Mm-hmm.
So they started this fund for financial assistance in case of natural disaster or family emergencies for their members.
Wow.
So if you have a house fire,
Your company helps take care of it.
It was started by Lisa Price, who at the time was the VP of Public Relations, Renee Ceruta, who was a district manager and is now in HR, Dixie McCullough, who was in the help desk and is now a senior recruiter, and Joan Moffitt, who is a regional manager, it is now senior operations consultant manager.
Mm.
So all of these ladies have started off in some sort of help position and have grown to larger
roles,
HR consultant roles.
Nice.
Yeah, and they started it very small. They started it just in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm. And they expanded the program out from there?
They have, and they've expanded it to a few other countries. I don't know the exact numbers. I wasn't able to find them. I don't believe it's in all of the countries you can find Starbucks.
Sure.
But it's good to start small and then grow.
Mm-hmm. Scale it up gradually so that you don't overextend yourself again.
Which Starbucks should have followed Cups.
Well, we'll get to that. All right,
yes.
So then 99. Then Starbucks makes another big acquisition, Tazo Tea. As a tea drinker, I appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
And also Hear Music. Interesting. Yeah. But they also did another 2-for-1 stock split. This would be number 3 if you're keeping count.
So 1 year, 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah. So not bad at all. Still growing quite a bit. Now, at this point, they're at nearly 2,500 stores. And they start promoting sustainable coffee growing practices through partnerships with Conservation International.
In 2000, they have 1,000 more stores. So they've grown by 1,000 stores in 1 year, mm-hmm. a third of the time it took for them to reach the last edition of 1,000 stores.
Mm-hmm. So not only are they're growing at an accelerated rate.
Yes, yes. They put more stores in Asia, more stores in the Middle East, and they start selling fair trade coffee in North America through Transfer USA.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard Schultz, in 2000, steps down as CEO.
Don't worry, he'll be back.
He will be.
Orrin Smith, who had been president of the company, then takes on the role of CEO. It's funny because I was reading up on Orrin Smith. He passed away a couple of years ago, sadly. But when he was CEO, he was also known as one of three very important people to Starbucks, the other two being Howard Schultz and then company president Howard Behar. And collectively, they were known as H2O. Because there were two Howards and one Orrin.
That's adorable.
I thought it was pretty good.
And H2O is an integral part of coffee.
It sure is. And so he was mostly known for taking very careful and deliberate decisions to guide the company. So he wasn't, he wasn't someone who would jump on the nearest fad thing, but he was very deliberate. He actually, a lot of the obituaries I read were... they praised him quite a bit. And Schultz even said without Orrin, there would have not been a Starbucks. It wouldn't have grown and it wouldn't have succeeded without him.
Yes. And some of the deliberate decisions he made were to start a Starbucks card,
mm-hmm.
release sourcing guidelines for ethical coffee growing, more growth. So they're up to 4,500 stores.
Mm-hmm.
And... another stock split. Another 2-for-1.
Yeah. So again, company still growing like gangbusters. 2002, they introduced probably the most important non-coffee, non-pastry product in a Starbucks, which would be Wi-Fi. And now they have more than 5,800 stores. And in 2003, they'd acquire a competitor, Seattle Coffee Company. So they purchased that, and they open up new roasting facilities, not places where you tell jokes about coworkers.
Oh, man, that would be fun. Maybe they do.
Well, it could be, but no, it's meant for coffee bean roasting. Yes. And by 2004, they're up to more than 7,000 stores.
And they had started a coffee master program. We talked about them teaching people how to roast beans and be able to tell quality of beans and differences of beans. And they also... introduce support centers for their Costa Rican farmers to help them in their farming practices.
Now, in 2005, something that had happened before happened again. And what would that be, Ariel?
More Frappuccinos?
Well, yes, but that's not what I was trying to get at.
No, they had a fifth stock split.
So again.
A fifth.
Yeah, which means that if you had owned stock originally, it would have split 5 times. You would have so much stock now. If you had just held on to the shares that you had at the very beginning, it's one of those dream situations. However, as it would turn out, this would be kind of a peak for Starbucks. It would continue to rise up a little bit over the following year or so, but we are now getting close to something that no one was predicting at the time and would end up being an enormous challenge for the company. But before we get into that, we need to take our own coffee break and thank our sponsor. All right, so in 2005, we have this fifth 2-for-1 stock split. But something else huge in Starbucks happens in 2005, which is that the CEO, Orrin Smith, retires.
Yes, and Jim Donald takes his place. He had joined Starbucks in 2002, whereas Orrin Smith had been a part of Starbucks for a while.
Yeah, for more than a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was almost like bringing in an outsider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had been the division president of North America before becoming CEO. And he came from a slightly, well, very different background because he was kind of a fixer, mm-hmm. right? He was the kind of guy who typically would go into a company that was struggling and turn things around, or he would end up selling off a ton of stuff so that the company could still exist. But Starbucks wasn't struggling. Starbucks was thriving at this point. So.
Maybe they were foreseeing their soon-to-come future.
Or maybe they were insuring it.
Maybe. Well, when he first became CEO, their annual earnings increased by 20%.
Yeah, so right away, it looks like this is an incredible decision.
Mm-hmm. And they, by 2007, they had grown to 15,000 stores. And they had introduced recycled cups or new and improved recycled cups mm-hmm. and healthier beverages. They took out trans fats and they made 2% their standard for milk. Like that's mm-hmm. the basic milk you'll get in a Starbucks drink unless you ask for something different.
And it wasn't all roses mm-mm. and coffee because there were a lot of stories and rumors about Donald having some clashes with Howard Schultz, who was still chairman of the board at the time.
Yeah.
So he was still very much involved in Starbucks. He just wasn't directly leading the company as CEO anymore.
But he still kind of wanted to lead the company, hence the headbutting.
Yeah. And then something beyond the company's control, beyond all of our control, well, I guess you could argue some people had a hand in it, the 2007 recession, the Great Recession really hit. Mm-hmm. And this was complicated by a lot of different factors, the real estate market, the banks, and all the
gas prices.
There were tons of things that were all happening at the same time. And it meant that people were suddenly more conscious of their expenditures. And they start looking at where they're spending their money and where they can make cuts. And a lot of people thought, hey, you know, I really love Starbucks. I like going into the stores and whatever, but you know, $4 for a cup of coffee, I could just drink the cheap stuff and I can save some cash here and there.
And then much to Starbucks' detriment, other food establishments realized that as well because McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts both launched gourmet coffees at their restaurants.
Right. So they see the opportunity here to undercut Starbucks. And so they're selling their gourmet coffees, but at a fraction of what Starbucks' asking prices were for their coffee drinks. And, I mean, also you could argue that this is what eventually would set Dunkin' Donuts on the path to just becoming Dunkin', but that's another topic for another episode.
Yeah, and, you know, on top of that, Starbucks has all of this growth it's doing.
Yeah.
It's moving so fast that to slow it down would take some time, and they have to spend money on all of this expansion they've planned and is in the process.
Oh, yeah. So the issue here was that they were expanding so quickly. Like we said, the expansion was actually accelerating many years. Like year over mm-hmm. year, you would look and say, oh, not only are they're growing faster than they were growing before. But now a recession hits while they're still in this growth mode. And this was where it looked like they had perhaps overextended themselves, that they had committed to opening all these stores and they're facing cutbacks in the number of customers that are coming into Starbucks places. So you're getting fewer customers walking into your Starbucks and you're opening more Starbucks at the same time. This can easily become a situation that can run away from you.
And it did because in 2007, when the recession hit, their stock prices dropped 42%.
Yikes.
That's a big hit.
So January 2008, the company, the board of directors, makes a pretty drastic decision, which is that Jim Donald, who, as we said, when he first came on, the revenues were up 20%, he has to hit the bricks. He is fired.
He must have thought it was opposite day on fixing companies.
And then that's also coincidentally, according to our notes here, the same day that McDonald's announced its specialty coffee shops, McCafes.
Yes. In 14,000 stores, which was not too far behind how many stores Starbucks had mm-hmm. when Donald came on. It is important to note here, at least I think it is, that Howard Schultz sent a memo to Jim Donald in early 2007, saying that he thought the company was being watered down. They weren't focusing on the right things. This is part of the headbutting we were talking about.
Yeah, and no one wants watered down coffee.
No. No, maybe a child.
You're not supposed to give a kid coffee?
With a lot of milk and sugar. Like, a lot of milk and sugar and a little bit of coffee.
You're a monster.
Listen, I've been drinking coffee since I was 4, okay?
It didn't stunt your growth. Ariel, by the way, in case you didn't know, is approximately 7.5 feet tall.
I'm 5'10". 5'9", if I haven't gotten a lot of sleep. but this memo got leaked to the public. So by July, before he was fired, they were already taking away a lot of his responsibilities.
Yeah, this is one of those tactics we've seen in a couple of other companies. We talked about it with Apple, about how they would take away more and more of Steve Jobs' responsibilities and kind of an effort to convince him to quit.
Yeah.
But Donald stuck around until he got the pink slip.
Yes. Well, once he was fired, Starbucks decided to restructure in a major way, and Howard Schultz came back on as CEO.
Yep.
He probably was like, I've got all these ideas.
I know what the company's soul is, and so I can restore it.
And I can bring it back to its former glory. And they had hoped that this restructure would turn the company around in a year, but it took 2 years. So they implemented a lot of good things that we're going to talk about.
It just took longer to really turn the company around. But to be fair, the recession was also still going on at this time. So even with the major changes we're talking about and the cool initiatives that they enacted, you have to keep in mind that the environment around these changes was still pretty dismal. It was, and that was beyond Schultz's control. However, there's some pretty interesting stuff that they tried out here.
Yeah. So first of all, they changed their mission statement. He really wanted to reconnect the customers with the company and build back that community that they had kind of forgotten in all of this expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So the new mission statement was, and this is a quote, to inspire and nurture the human spirit, one person, one cup, and one neighborhood at a time.
So this was a reaction to that, like you were saying, that rapid expansion where it kind of takes away the personal touch. You're focusing so much on opening up the next store that you're not really cultivating the community that Starbucks was kind of built around originally.
Yes.
And he also, Schultz had kind of an open door policy saying, if you have any concerns or ideas or anything, you can communicate them to me and I will listen to you. He also said that, quote, the company shouldn't just blame the economy. Starbucks's heavy spending to accommodate its expansion has created a bureaucracy that masked its problems, end quote. So he's actually saying, yeah, the recession is a thing and that is affecting us. But let's be honest, there have been some decisions made in this company that have set it on the wrong path. So he's kind of throwing some shade toward Donald there.
I think it's some pretty big shade because the growth started before Donald came on.
Yeah.
The exponential growth. And he only did the last 2-for-1 stock split, I believe.
And to be fair also, I mean, we all know as a shareholder in a company, shareholders expect returns on their investment. So CEOs really focus on growth a lot because that's how you get a return on investment. I mean, you can be the best at what you do, but if you're not growing, then shareholders aren't necessarily super duper happy. So Donald had focused on that specific part of the business, possibly to the detriment of other parts of the business.
So in 2008, to additionally help Starbucks' image, they closed 7,100 shops to retrain their baristas.
Mm-hmm.
They retrain them on how to make better espressos. They train them on grinding beans in store for a better product. And they implement throwing out coffee that was brewed over 30 minutes prior to being poured.
Yeah, anything that was 30 minutes old or older would get thrown out. And then you brew a new pot or a new urn or a new vat.
Yes.
But this to me speaks a lot because it's essentially sending the message that the experience is what we're selling here. It's not really the coffee we're selling. We're selling the experience. And if that means that we have to take a bath on some of this coffee, like you brew, let's say you brew a full carafe and it's a slow day and you only sell maybe 5 cups of coffee and then 30 minutes pass, that's it. We're going to
pour out the— Our customers are more important than that coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, doing this, closing all of these stores for one day cost them $6 million.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, this is not a small decision. This is—
Not at all.
And it really does kind of speak to Schultz's commitment at this stage to turning the spirit of the company around.
Yeah, and he doesn't do it all himself. He hires outside consultants to help him come up with more strategies, including their first national advertising campaign, which they ran before, after, during SNL, about the time of SNL during the presidential campaign that year.
Yeah, and Starbucks has, for the most part, relied heavily on word of mouth advertising as opposed to, and some traditional, like billboard advertising and stuff. They would later find out that there were other methods that were much more effective.
Yes. They also updated their website and launched My Starbucks Idea.
Now, this was pretty incredible.
Yes. It was a customer-to-customer and a customer-to-business community where people could put their ideas and thoughts in and directly interact with each other and the company providing them their goods.
So you could submit an idea. Maybe you think, what if you have water beds in all the stores that we could all just lounge on while drinking coffee? And they could say—
And they're filled with coffee.
They're filled with steaming hot coffee. You can scald yourself on these boiling hot water beds. And the company would probably say, that one's not such a good idea.
Yeah.
But someone else might say, why don't you have like a loyalty card where after a couple of visits, you get a free coffee? And they say, that's a good idea.
Well, the website was a good idea because customers liked it so much that they gave them over 93,000 ideas.
Yeah. The Starbucks would end up employing much fewer than 93,000.
Yes. And they got 5.5 million views a month on their webpage.
Mm-hmm.
And then Starbucks began focusing on social media. So we talked about this in our episode about Old Spice. It's really important to engage current markets in social media.
Sure.
They feel listened to, so they're going to feel more loyal to your product.
Yeah, and this was where I was talking about how this part of marketing ended up being way more successful than their traditional. And it was a fraction of the cost. Like even when they would offer up what sounded like incredible deals, in the long run, they were much less expensive than running a traditional marketing campaign where you're buying billboard space or, you know, signs on buses or something.
Yeah.
Here's a funny little side note I discovered while I was researching this topic. One of their most successful early tweets was just a smiley face, and it was sent by accident. The social media person who was working for Starbucks did not mean to only post a smiley face, but it ended up getting a very positive reception from people following the Starbucks Twitter feed.
See, she should have just claimed it as purposeful.
Yeah. I meant to smile.
They also updated their cash registers and espresso machines, which saved customers about 700,000 hours of waiting in line.
Yeah.
And then they cut back on music in stores, so they had diversified a bit too much. They had shelves of CDs and music playing.
I remember those. Like I remember. I've bought a few CDs, like especially like the sample ones, where it'd be a bunch of different artists, and usually there'd be maybe two on there that I would be aware of, and then a whole bunch I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they definitely decided to cut back on the music store side of what Starbucks was, which is probably a good idea. I mean, we saw the same thing happening in big box stores, because we're talking also around the time where music is starting to go way more digital delivery than on hard media.
And then they did something on the back end, which is so important. It's just so important. They reorganized their supply chains because they had only been getting delivery accuracy of 30%.
Mm.
Which, how do you have that and not fix that problem?
Yeah.
If only 30% of your deliveries are accurate, how do you not look at that far in advance of this point and go, we need to fix this problem?
Yeah. The only thing I could say is maybe it was one of those things where, again, the company grew so fast that no one could get a handle on this problem until it absolutely had to be tackled.
Yeah. But after this reorganization, their deliveries were 90% accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So a really good fix.
Yeah. My favorite thing about this part of the whole development system was that they had a feature called My Starbucks Signature, where you could customize your own style drink. Like, let's say that you have a particular type of latte where that you've got, you know, caramel and peppermint or something in it, and you decide to call it the Hot Johnny, because that's my drink, the Hot Johnny, peppermint and caramel.
That's really?
No, No, okay. I'm giving you a theoretical thing. I do like peppermint mochas.
I do like peppermint mochas too.
And peppermint hot chocolate. And I also like caramel apple cider, but I would not have a caramel apple peppermint mocha. That would be disgusting, I think. But you could make a various, you know, you can make a drink within a certain level of parameters. Like you couldn't go super crazy with it, but you could customize it. You could name the drink and then you could share your drink on the Starbucks community. So if other people saw it and thought, oh, that sounds good, I can try that next time, they could actually order your drink the next time they go to a Starbucks.
I've done that.
Oh,
wow. I've done that. They also closed 600 stores.
Yeah, this was not an immediate cure for the ills of Starbucks.
And it was a lot more stores than they intended to close. They had only intended to close 100 stores originally.
Yeah, it turned out that that was not going to be enough for them to be able to get a handle on this. And it wasn't just stores closing. They had to say goodbye to a lot of employees.
Yeah, about 12,000 of them.
And before they got better, things would get worse. In the summer of 2008, Starbucks reported its first ever quarterly loss. And there was a real fear that even with these initiatives, the company had grown so quickly and then overextended itself during the recession that it might not be able to catch itself. It might just constantly be trying to, you know, manage costs until the company falls apart. But things didn't quite turn out that way. We'll explain more in just a second, but first, let's take another quick break to thank our sponsor.
So as we said, things got worse before they got better. Not only did they report their first ever quarterly loss, by November of 2008, Starbucks' net income had dropped 97% from the previous year. And their stocks were down 56%.
Yeah, when you've dropped your revenue by almost 100%, that's not good. Or your income, I should say. Yeah, they had to close another 300 stores in 2009, so the bleeding was not yet over. 70% of those were new stores. They were less than 3 years old.
And they had to lay off another 6,700 employees. 6,000 of them worked in store, and 700 were non-store employees, so like customer support and website and things like that.
Yeah. They ended also licensing out some of the remaining stores instead of just owning them outright. So sort of like a franchise model. And they thought, well, maybe this would make more sense rather than committing our full resources to opening up more stores in the future. We can have a more measured growth strategy.
Yes, but they didn't cut back on everything.
Mm-hmm.
So they did not cut back on their health care for their employees. And it cost them $250 million in 2009, but it was real important to keep that benefit for their partners who were still working with them.
Yeah, and this was just the beginning of changes with Starbucks, right?
Yeah, they had more restructuring. They got in some new executives. They redesigned stores. They increased employee salaries based on performance, which I'm sure some people view as unfair, but I know that I like being recognized for working hard and doing a good job.
Yeah, well, and it, again, it helps your, if you are a company that just had to lay off thousands of employees, and your remaining employees are now worried because they aren't certain how sure their future is. But then you turn around and say, listen, no, we are committing ourselves to rewarding employees for their performance. That could go a long way to help restore employee morale and confidence.
Yeah. And then they introduced instant coffee, which did pretty well.
Yeah. All right.
You don't like instant coffee?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I like coffee that takes a long time.
Well, enough people did like the instant coffee.
Yeah.
And they launched their mobile app in 2009, and it had rewards programs and promos and payment options.
Yeah, these days you can, you know, just load money on your mobile app and use that to pay for your coffees, which is exactly how I do it.
Yup.
Also in 2009, there was a trend that was forming in places like New York City. I remember reading about this. Actually, I might have even covered it for the show Tech Stuff I did, because it intersects with tech stuff. You had coffee shops. It was almost standard procedure at that point for coffee shops to have Wi-Fi as a way of attracting customers, but they were having a problem. They would attract customers who would come in, buy a cup of coffee, and then leech off the Wi-Fi for, you know, 5-6 days. But yeah. No, like sit there and just park it for a real long time on one cup of coffee. So you had these independent coffee shops in New York. They were not Starbucks coffee shops that started to employ policies where they would kick you out if you hadn't bought anything after a while.
Well, and New York shops are real tough, too. Like, you can't use their bathroom unless you buy something, oftentimes.
So Starbucks, Schultz comes out and says, you know what? We're not doing that at Starbucks. If you want to come in and buy a cup of coffee, stay as long as you want. We want to have a welcoming environment. It's a social environment. It's not just a place for you to buy a cup of coffee. If you want to come in and work all day and you've bought a cup of coffee, feel free. Stay here as long as you like. And to me, this is really interesting because it's like the flip side of the way we would normally see this story play out. Because normally what you would see is the big faceless corporation saying, no, we want to maximize our space and our profits. So if you're not drinking coffee, get out. And then the smaller companies could say, oh, let's take advantage of that. We'll welcome more people into our shop. And sure, they'll stick around longer, but we'll get more customers this way. But we saw it the other way around. The big company was the one saying, no, come on in.
Well, and if you've got somebody who would maybe buy one cup of coffee and stay all day and work, you invite them to stay. They might buy a second cup of coffee in the afternoon.
Or maybe, who knows, maybe a croissant.
A croissant.
Or some other tasty pastry.
And also it sticks Starbucks in your mind that if your power goes out or there's a blizzard, go work there.
Your own little Wi-Fi connection at your house goes out, and so you need to take a quick walk to the coffee shop, as I do pretty much any day I work from home. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ends up being a reliable place. 2010 would see things starting to really turn around again in a positive way for Starbucks. For one thing, the Great Recession was now at an end as well, so that also helped. It wasn't just that the company was implementing these changes, it was also that the economy in general was starting to pick up.
Well, it wasn't just the recession or just Starbucks that caused the fall.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that both contributed to the
recovery.
The upswing. Yeah. By 2011, Starbucks was making $10 billion in revenue.
Yeah, that's billion dollars.
Billion, yes. And they were back up to 150,000 employees.
Yes. And then in 2012, the most important point in Starbucks history happened. That's when they introduced the blonde roast.
Is that historically verified important or Jonathan verified important?
The two are synonymous. Ariel, as far as you are concerned, they are one and the same. So here's why blonde roast is important. Here's a quick coffee education for you guys out there who maybe you like coffee, maybe you don't know a whole lot about it. You might know a ton, but for those who don't know, light roasts have more caffeine in them. Dark roasts have a richer taste. The oils and everything in the coffee bean are now at a point where you get that really strong coffee flavor, but they are not strong in caffeine compared to light roasts. So the longer you roast a bean, the more caffeine gets leached out of it, which means espressos, which have a very strong taste, are actually not nearly as full of caffeine as, say, a light roast.
So blonde roast is good for people who don't like coffee flavor but like getting the caffeine buzz?
I like coffee flavor. I just really want the most bang for my buck. Listen, you see what my work's like.
I do.
That's why I need a good old venti blonde roast from Starbucks right across the street first thing in the morning. Anyway, that's why it's the most important date in Starbucks history.
All right, back to the facts. In 2015, Starbucks reached a really important milestone for all of the mission statements they had. They claimed by 2015 to be 99% ethically sourced in their coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty good. And then they introduce another 2-for-1 stock split.
Yay, back to that.
10 years later, the sixth one.
Yeah.
And then once again, investing in the community, they start a college program for qualifying partners, so for qualifying employees, that pays entirely for their 4-year undergraduate schooling.
That's amazing.
That is. They committed to having 25,000 graduated partners by 2025.
That's fantastic. So 2017 would actually see Howard Schultz step down again as CEO. He retired. And he did an interview in Fortune in 2017. He said that the thing he didn't get right when he first left Starbucks, the first time, was succession planning, that he didn't come up with the right way to transition the company to a new leader in a way that would be sustainable in the long run. And that's a story we've said over and over on The Brink, is the idea that you've got to have good succession planning in place, especially when you have a company that is very closely identified with the philosophy of one of its early leaders.
Yeah.
So we've seen in so many stories about how the company apparently lost its way after the resignation or death of, say, a founder or a truly iconic leader in the company. And a lot of that is because there wasn't the appropriate succession planning in place to make sure that things continue to operate smoothly and within the parameters of the original vision.
Yeah, you need to make sure that you've got somebody who can find a good balance between the original vision and changing that vision to fit with modern times.
Yes, yeah.
Because you do also see companies that stick to their original vision.
And then they become obsolete.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a delicate line.
We talk about those from time to time, too.
Sure, sure. So who comes in charge after Schultz steps down again? It's a Mr. Kevin Johnson. And at first, it was at a rough time because sales were actually slowing down when Johnson would take over. But that was a temporary situation.
Yes. By 2017, Starbucks had almost 26,000 stores.
That's a lot of stores.
Yes, in 75 countries.
Uh-huh.
On every continent but Antarctica. But I hear they're opening one soon. No, I'm kidding.
I bet they won't sell too many Frappuccinos in Antarctica. And then they also recently, as in like 2018, had another tough PR moment where they had some very publicized incidents of discrimination happening in some Starbucks stores. And so the company did something pretty extreme, just like they had when they spent, you know, when they essentially said goodbye to $6 million in revenue and they closed all these stores so they could have employee training. They decided to do a very similar thing in the United States. Every single Starbucks location was shut down in April 2018 so that employees would be able to go through mandatory racial bias training to address the problem of discrimination. So employees were trained to recognize bias, both in themselves and in others, to promote conscious inclusion, and to make sure everyone in a Starbucks feels safe and welcome. So we still see reports of incidents now and then, but this was a sign that the company was really trying to commit to this ethos that they had embraced upon their founding.
Now, unfortunately, in 2018, they also started planning another restructuring with more layoffs, leadership changes, because sales in the U.S. were down and they had more competition and things like that.
Yeah. And also, Schultz, meanwhile, the former CEO, is now in the headlines as we record this episode because he is contemplating a run for the president of the United States in 2020, a decision that many in the political sphere find vexing.
But we'll leave that for a political podcast. We do have a couple of fun facts. Mm-hmm. Something I didn't know is that the name Starbucks comes from Moby Dick.
Yep. I knew that.
I did not.
Yeah.
Also that the company was almost named
Pequod.
Pequod.
It could have been Queequeg, another character from Moby Dick, or Ishmael.
Ishmael.
Call me Ishmael. Also, we have to mention the famous logo.
Yes.
The mermaid.
Which I also didn't know was a mermaid. I've looked at that logo so many times, and it took me way too long to realize it was a mermaid.
Have you seen the meme of how the logo has changed over the years?
I haven't.
So in the meme, you see the logo of the mermaid, and in each successive redesign, the mermaid is a little closer to the, like she's her face is taking up more and more of the circle.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like she's getting closer and closer to the circle. And so they project out that the next logo, she's going to be climbing through the circle like the girl in the ring.
Oh, no.
It's hilarious.
Well, I'm glad that the first version wasn't a single-tailed mermaid. And then every time they did a stock split, they added another tail.
Yeah. She's a seven-tailed mermaid. Well, that wraps up our talk about Starbucks and how they were able to turn things around. And again, like we said, succession planning was a big part of it. And also just trying to expand too quickly can really turn around and bite you. So cautionary tales. And it remains to be seen how the Nestle-Starbucks agreement's going to go. Again, it's not like Nestle's taken ownership of Starbucks or anything like that, but still, it can raise eyebrows for a company that has put so much of its reputation in conservation and ethical treatment and all that kind of stuff.
We might have to cover it in a future episode.
Yeah, it may very well be that we'll revisit this. In the meantime, where can they reach us if they want to send us questions or suggestions?
Well, you can email us at feedback@thebrinkpodcast.show.
Yes.
You can also visit our website to find past episodes or information about Jonathan and I at thebrinkpodcast.show.
Yep. And until next time, I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Ariel Kasten.